Welcome to Southern Maryland Perspectives. My name is Brad Gottfried, and I'm the President Emeritus of the College of Southern Maryland. This is a talk show that features timely topics and guests from around the region. With me today is Mr. C.R. Gibbs. He has been a guest several times on the show. I was mentioning to Mr. Gibbs that I think he holds the record for the number of times he's been on the show. And today, Mr. Gibbs is going to be telling us about African Americans serving in World War I with a special emphasis on Maryland. Mr. Gibbs, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. Good morning. Pleased to be here.
Yes. Thank you so much. If you could, and I know many of the listeners remember you from past appearances, but could you remind the listeners a little bit about yourself, your background?
Well, I am a historian, author, and lecturer. The recently, Georgetown University reprinted a book that I co-wrote called Black Georgetown Remembered. This is the 25th anniversary of this book, and it was the first modern history of African Americans in Georgetown. It was published by the University Press of Georgetown. And this time, in honor of it being around for 25 years and for there still being interest in it, they slapped a hardcover on it this time, so I'm finally in the big time with that book. And of course, this year I'm spending time on the, since the rest of the world is observing the commemorating World War I, the centennial of World War I, I thought I would do something specifically on the with a local look. You know, a national look is fine, and there are many books and what have you on that. And the national theme in February, in fact, is African Americans in time of war, or so that we understand that there's always an interest going on. It was my honor several years ago to write the first book on the African American Civil War Regiment from the nation's capital. And so, you know, those are some of the things, in addition to writing a book on black explorers and black inventors.
Mm. I have to ask you a question, and I don't want to throw you for a loop, and I hate surprises, so excuse me if it is.
Mm-hmm.
But you mentioned that Georgetown University has republished your book.
Mm-hmm.
Georgetown has been in the press within the last year, when they realized, you know, the connection they had with slaves and slavery. How do you feel about the response? Do you feel that it was an appropriate response for the university?
Well, it's interesting you should ask that. I do an annual lecture up at the university, and in it I talk about slavery and the college and the impact of slavery on the Georgetown community.
Mm-hmm.
And I am told, this is what I'm told, is that some of the kids, some of my information served as a bit of a spur. I claim no sea change or anything like that, no watershed moment, but in talking about how it is that the ghost of slavery still stalked the cobblestone streets of Georgetown, this got some of the students into looking and thinking about the institution of slavery in the larger college.
Mm-hmm.
And so if that in any way helped to bring the students to a greater awareness, I do know that, in talking about slavery in Georgetown, some of the kids, in fact, a young man wrote an article after going to one of my lectures. This is some years ago, and he looked at slavery at the university and found out that many of the Southern students would sell slaves to Georgetown to finance their tuition.
Oh.
And so, you know, that I didn't know that at the time. My focus had been, and in the book, it's primarily, with my co-authors, it's primarily on the impact of slavery and the African-American presence in Georgetown as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
But to find out that the university leans so heavily on revenue from enslaved people, and that the 1838 sale of nearly 300 enslaved people helped to rescue Georgetown University from financial debt is quite a thing for it to deal with.
Yes.
Now, I was up there. I do my lectures every September. As of this past September, which will be September 2017, as part of, if you will, reparations, there are one or two descendant students that have entered Georgetown.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that is the beginning of perhaps a new relationship, a new era between Georgetown and the larger African-American community. I mean, we're looking at similar things happening at colleges
yes.
and universities across the country that go back to that time. And most recently, Princeton University is about to embark on a similar soul-searching and a review of the impact. We know that several heads of Princeton were slave owners and that slave sales occurred in front of the president's house on the Princeton campus.
Hmm.
So it's not a distant kind of thing,
mm-hmm.
nor was it confined specifically to Southern universities.
Mm-hmm. Do you find, though, that most universities are addressing their past appropriately, or there's some who are basically just ignoring it?
It's still difficult. Some are addressing it. A few are addressing it. I think that number will grow. I'm hopeful that it will grow. And then there are just some who are still, how shall I put this, going with business as usual. But that's true even for some of the pasts of the historic mansions in Georgetown today that date back to that period. Some have fessed up, and some have done yeoman jobs in opening up that aspect of history, particularly when you often consider that on whether it's on the average plantation, black folk outnumber white folk. I mean, to not tell that story or to keep it hidden is to deprive everyone of a significant part of the history of that whole place.
Hmm. Thank you for that. I know I digress from our topic, but it's such a timely issue, and I think all of the listeners need to hear your perspective. So thank you. That was very helpful.
Yeah, some of the descendants are not entirely happy with the way Georgetown has done it. Some feel that they've been left out of some of the decision-making, but in the main, I think most are reasonably pleased with it. It's far from perfect, but
yes.
Again, the idea that descendant students are now on the camp, only two to that, as of September, but I think that will be a beginning.
Yes, and hopefully many more in the future.
Yes.
Well, let's talk about the matter at hand. It's Maryland African Americans serving in World War I, and as you mentioned, this is an appropriate topic given the centennial of World War I. Mr. Gibbs, about how many black or African Americans served in the armed forces in World War I? Do you have a sense of that?
Oh, well, we know that approximately 367,000 served. It's a larger number of African Americans than served in the American Civil War. And it just seems to be rarely depicted in films or TV. It's been surveyed nationally in some excellent books, but it's not well known in terms of the popular imagination.
Now, I think we know more about the conditions in World War II, maybe because of what happened after with Truman and some of the changes in terms of desegregation. But in what capacity did African Americans serve in World War I? And then I'm going to ask you, were they well treated? Were they given the roles that they deserved?
Well, let me do it this way. If I can focus on Maryland for just
yes,
a moment,
certainly.
Then if we look at what was happening in Maryland just a few years before World War I, it will give our listeners an idea of what black people faced.
Okay, good.
For example, there were repeated attempts to disenfranchise black people. Between 1905 and 1911, the Poe Amendment, the Diggs Amendment, the Strauss Amendment, and then beginning in 1908, there was an attempt to institute grandfather clauses in Annapolis. So, you know, this gives you, and when you put that in the pot alongside Jim Crow and lynching in the state of Maryland, it was extremely difficult. And I think this is why black folk and progressive whites decided to form the Baltimore NAACP in 1913, which makes the Baltimore branch the second oldest NAACP branch.
How interesting. What is the oldest, by the way?
That would be the one, I believe, in New York.
Okay.
Yeah.
That would make sense.
Yeah. Other than the formation of the main organization itself, but they decided, and then one of the things that I want to salute the Maryland voters in general for is that between 1905 and say 1911 or so, every time the disenfranchisement amendments were proposed, they were ultimately shot down. And then in 1915, while the fires of war are already burning in Europe, there's a major case that Myers v. Anderson that kills the grandfather clause and rules it unconstitutional. So, you know, that's something. But of course, you still got to deal with the degradation attached to Jim Crow and the violence. But when war was declared, and this year, 2017, is the centennial of America's entry into World War I in April of 1917.
So do we know approximately, you mentioned 367,000 nationwide, do we know approximately how many Marylanders entered the armed forces?
About 11,000, near as we can tell. About approximately 11,000 African Americans from Maryland and in World War One, and about 500 or so in the naval services.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm going to show my ignorance, but did we have a draft for World War One, or were mainly enlistments?
I believe there was a draft. What I can tell you is that nationally, 96% of black soldiers were drafted, and black soldiers were disproportionately drafted.
Okay.
So if they went in front of their draft boards, there was every likelihood that a higher percentage of them would be drafted into the military than white males.
And once they were inducted into the armed forces, you mentioned a smaller number, obviously, in the Navy. What were some of the roles that they were given? Were there any combat roles, for instance, or was it mainly support services?
There was a combat role for an absolutely fascinating unit called the 1st Separate Company, based in Baltimore, the 1st Separate Company. The military ardor generated by service in the Civil War never left the African-American community. And in the district, you had the 1st Separate Battalion, which was the apple of the eye of the black community. And in Baltimore, you had a similar organization, originally known as the Monumental City Guards, and they were finally accepted into the state National Guard organization. This is in the 1880s. And the 1st Separate Company is going to serve in World War One, and they're going to be incorporated mostly as Company I of the 372nd Infantry Regiment, and they're going to be put there alongside the roughly 10,000 black men from the standing National Guard organizations, because at this point, they're only essentially the Buffalo Soldiers, the four regiments of black men on the Western frontier, and black men in the state National Guards. And not all state National Guards, I might add, but D.C., Maryland, Connecticut, Massachusetts, Ohio, Illinois, and New York.
I see.
Yeah, and now they could not do everything, and it is true, I do need to say this in terms of perspective, they were not permitted to do everything, so that the vast majority of black men in World War One worked in the SOS. It was known as Services of Supply. It's a nice way of saying the quartermaster, which would be the same case in World War II.
Mm-hmm.
But at least in World War I and World War II, there were combat outfits. And the 372nd Infantry Regiment, which Baltimore was separate company, was part of, saw a great deal of combat.
I'm with Mr. C.R. Gibbs. We're talking about Maryland, African Americans, and World War I in honor of the centennial of America's entry into that great war. When you talk about the drafting of all Americans, were there when a African American received his draft notice, was that segregated, or was there one draft address that they would go to? For instance, in Baltimore, was that segregated, or did they all report to the same? To the same office?
Well, segregation managed to find its way almost into every proverbial nook and cranny, but the draft itself was usually scheduled separately, as I understand it. There were obviously times when, for necessity, that could not have been the case, but we know that there were examinations, and there would be... In fact, a number of men would find themselves even not just confined to the first separate company, because the first separate company was so small. At its greatest, when on the eve of combat, we're basically talking about 154 men and three officers. In 1911, it was probably about 50 men and three officers, 47 men and three officers. So the company was never very large, but again, it occupied a prideful place in the community. And because they were a regularly organized institution, although the operative word here in D.C. and Maryland is separate, the first separate battalion, which for a time would train. There may be some listeners who are familiar with D.C., and the D.C. 1st Separate Battalion trained at the True Reformers Hall right on U Street, right at 12th and U. The 1st Separate Company, I think, had limited access to the old regimental armory, but that would be forgotten. And in the perhaps the final example of separateness, the... 1st Separate Company and the 1st Separate Battalion from the district would go on to make up, along with the other Black National Guard units, they would be attached to the French Army once they were trained and sent overseas. They would be part of the 93rd Division, which was actually never put together in actuality. I guess the nicest word is provisional. But they would be attached to the French Army with French equipment and uniforms.
Wow. Now, that really is a surprise.
Yeah. The American Army simply was not ready. They were not ready for Black officers to any particular degree, because of the idea of, even in the heat of battle, the perception that there might come a time when a Black officer might have to tell a white enlisted man what to do was an anathema to the Army High Command. So... they felt it was much better to keep things as separate as possible. And so when the first troops in the 93rd went over, they were attached to the French Army. And who knew that it was going to be as successful as it was? And indeed, it was extremely successful. Without the American racism, the troops from the 93rd performed admirably, superbly, in going over the top in the days of trench warfare.
Now, how did the French interact with the African Americans from America? Were they welcomed? Were they kept separate? How did they interact with them?
My French is terrible, Dr. Gottfried, but one story is that when the men from the old 15th New York, which would be put in the 369th Infantry Regiment, went over to the French, And one of the commanders talked about, you know, we've been treated like orphans. The French officer is reputedly said, well, in that case, you know, welcome little black babies because we're happy. France had been bled after, you know, fighting since 1914. They were ready for an infusion of men, and they did not care what color they were.
Now, I assume, was this mainly just African-Americans sent over to serve in French units? Were any Caucasians sent over as well?
This particular part was mainly African-American.
Okay.
And in that regiment, in the 369th, which is probably also known as the Harlem Hellfighters, they never lost a foot of ground, and they advanced farther than any American unit, black or white, into enemy territory. They also gave us not only the first African-American heroes of World War One, that is Henry Johnson and Needham Roberts, but there was a man from Baltimore who was a one-man version of Needham Roberts and Henry Johnson, and his name was Bill Butler. Butler, if I could, with your permission, just share a moment of a description about this young man.
Definitely.
So let's see, Bill Butler. Herbert Corey, a white newspaper correspondent, in telling of the incident, said that Butler came a roaring and fogging through the darkness with his automatic, and nobody knew how many Germans he killed. It was for this that General Pershing awarded him the Distinguished Service Cross recently, and the citation read, quote, Sergeant William Butler, Company L, 369th Infantry Regiment, for extraordinary heroism in action near Maison de Champagne, France, August 18, 1918, Sergeant Butler broke up a German raiding party which had succeeded in entering our trenches and capturing some of our men. With an automatic rifle, he killed four of the raiding party and captured or put to flight the remainder of the invaders. His home address, Mrs. Jenny Butler, Water Street, Salisbury, Maryland. And then he was also, the New York Tribune reported on him almost at the about 10 days later. Bill Butler, a slight, good-natured colored youth who until 2 years ago was a jack of all trades in a little Maryland town, yesterday came into his own as a hero among heroes. And more than 5,000 men and women arose to their feet in City College Stadium and cheered themselves hoarse, while representatives of two governments pinned their highest medals upon the breast of the nervous youth. Sergeant Butler was one of a list of 23 members of the famous 15th Regiment, upon whom both France and the United States conferred medals of honor because of extraordinary heroism on European battlefields.
Wow. So what happened to him when he returned to the States and became a civilian again?
What we believed happened is probably what happened to the other members of his regiment. Now, he was, although from Maryland, part of the old 15th, part of the 369th Harlem Hellfighters. Most of those men went back to menial jobs and died largely unremembered except by their family.
Let's talk about, you mentioned the first separate company that actually served in the 322nd Infantry Regiment?
372nd Infantry Regiment.
Oh, 72nd, okay.
So
they were actually, they were part of a, basically it was an all-white unit then, except for this one company?
The United States Army sent roughly 10,000 black men, which were the mostly National Guard outfits, and they sent them over in the 369th, the Infantry Regiment, the 370th Infantry Regiment, the 371st Infantry Regiment, and the 372nd Infantry Regiment. And they were certainly the only black men inside French Infantry Division, the 157th French Infantry Division. It was known as the Red Hand Division.
Now, is there a sense of the number of Marylanders or African-Americans in general that died in combat?
We have a you know, I had looked for that for some years. What I can tell you is that there were 773 of the 52,000 total combat deaths. Roughly 2% of the black troops formed 2% of the casualties in the American Expeditionary Force, and 4,400 blacks were wounded out of 200,000 soldiers.
Now, were they, these men, were they, as soon as we entered the war, engaged, or was it later in the war?
Well, that's the interesting thing. I mean, they, because they were National Guard troops, they were pretty much ready to go.
Right from the start.
They had to be sent usually to Camp Meade. Now today we call it Fort Meade.
Right.
But understand that one of the indignities was that the train line that these men took from D.C. as well as Baltimore was Jim Crow. Mm. So that even though President Wilson talked loudly about making the world safe for democracy, many African Americans during the First World War hoped that America would be made safe for democracy. And you know, this was something that, that they struggled for. And they hoped that their military service would, in some way, stand as a testament to their patriotism, to their loyalty to their country.
Yes,
there was a huge meeting at the in Cambridge, for example, a few months after the America entered the war. Actually, that was the next year. It was in 1918, and there was a huge meeting. And the governor came and talked about the use of black soldiers and how important it was to the war effort. And this is the kind of thing that African Americans, you know, wanted. They wanted to be recognized for that they had served their country in every war it had been in, and yet they were denied citizenship, full citizenship, and the violence that had. Because they were still lynching black men on the eastern shore of Maryland well into the 1930s.
Wow.
So, you know, they wanted an end to this kind of treatment, and they wanted to be respected. And we find that in Maryland, we had, well, as well as the other states, black women were doing war work, what was known as war work, and that could be everything from food conservation to helping women who, whose husbands are in the military, you know, helping to take care of them. So we have participation from every part of the African-American community. And we have, although it's not just the military that sometimes is discriminating, it's also civilian agencies in many respects as well.
We have just a couple minutes left. But when you consider what happened during World War One in terms of how we utilized our black soldiers and what they came home to, was it very similar to what they experienced in World War Two? Were there any improvements in World War Two, or was it basically more of the same?
I think the best and briefest answer I can give is a famous, just a portion of a famous editorial that was in Crisis, the NAACP magazine. We believe that W.E.B. Du Bois wrote it. And he said, we return from fighting, we return fighting, but by the God of heaven, we are cowards and jackasses if now that the war is over, we do not marshal every ounce of our brain and brawn to fight a sterner, longer, more unbending battle against the forces of hell in our own land.
Wow. And unfortunately, that was after World War One, and then still it remained after World War Two.
And a number of the African Americans that served in World War One would serve as models, teachers, and inspiration for the soldiers from black soldiers from World War Two.
I can imagine. This has been fascinating. You know, all of us need to hear more about the role of our African American soldiers in World War One. And I want to thank you, Mr. Gibbs, for taking the time to share your expertise with us, the listeners in Southern Maryland.
Thank you. Let me anyone that cares is invited to join us in the lecture series at the Greenbelt Library in Greenbelt, Maryland. You can go online and look up the schedule. We begin the new series on January the 30th, 2018.
Excellent. Definitely, and I'll check that out as well. I'd love to meet you in person. So thank you so much, Mr. Gibbs, for being a guest on the show.
Thank you.
I also want to thank you, the listeners, for tuning in, and I hope you'll join me next week for another edition of Southern Maryland Perspectives. Until that time, I'm Brad Gottfried, President Emeritus of the College of Southern Maryland.